just to repeat what we did during the morning session. Okay, so we discussed the idea that the Buddha is reliable. Can you hear me? No? Oh. Can you hear me now? Okay, so the Buddha is... Maybe our doctor just arrived? the Buddha is said to be reliable, but we have no way of knowing that ourselves unless we take the reasonings, unless we get to an understanding through inference. It's coming to see that the Buddha is reliable. And getting to know, well, the importance of knowing that is, or the reason we should know, is how can we rely on someone? How can we rely on someone who basically takes us through the different stages of the path? And of course, it's not like we receive one teaching and that's it. But the idea is that the Buddha is represented by our lamas, like our teachers, who gently take us through the different stages. And so to follow their instructions, well, we should have the faith, we should have the understanding, not just the faith, the understanding that we can rely on them. And that is only possible if we understand the Buddha is reliable. And of course then that our teachers, well, have the understanding that they're enlightened beings after we've investigated well and so forth. Okay. And that can of course only take place if we have understood that the Buddha's teachings are reliable. So we need to study the Dharma, we need to learn about the Dharma and see whether, well, for us personally, it makes sense and it's something we find helpful and moreover reliable. But then more specifically, we discussed Dignaga's homage, which the second chapter of Dharmakirti's commentary on Dignaga's commentary, it deals specifically with the two lines of homage. So it discusses or presents the five factors that are introduced in the homage. First, the Buddha himself being a well-recognizer being, and then the two excellent causes, great compassion and the realization of selflessness, or the mind that trains in the realization of selflessness at the state of bodhisattva. Yeah, so great compassion and the mind realizing selflessness during the training period. And then, of course, the two resultant states, first sugata, which refers to realizations and eliminations. That's the first. And the second, the Buddha being a protector. Those are the five factors, the two results, realizations, and, well, it sounds like there are three, there are actually three, but the sugata is subdivided into two, the realizations of a Buddha and the eliminations of a Buddha. Okay, so those refer to sugata, and then the Buddha being a protector, which means the Buddha's different emanations teaching other sentient beings. All right, so those are the five factors, and we've also heard that not only are those five factors presented during the second chapter, you can divide the second chapter into two sections. The first section in general explains those five factors in accordance with the sequence of those five, the way they're represented by Dignaga. First, well-recognizer being, just get a rough explanation of what that means, great compassion, selflessness, and then all the other factors up to the protector. That's what the first section does. The second section explains those five, but this way, the other way around. First, it explains protector, then it explains sugata, it explains teacher, realization of selflessness, great compassion. Teacher and realization of selflessness are the same thing here. The realization of selflessness is a school teacher. Great compassion and the Buddha being a well-recognizer being. So in those two sections, those five factors are explained, but one in the according to the forward order, one according to the reverse order. Moreover, during those sections, these sections are meant to prove that the Buddha is a well-recognizer being, in other words, that the Buddha is reliable. And how is it done? During the first section, first great compassion is proven. Great compassion then establishes the mind that realizes selflessness. The mind that realizes selflessness then establishes the realizations and eliminations of the Buddha. And the eliminations of the Buddha, the eliminations and the realizations establish that the Buddha is a protector. And that lastly then establishes that the Buddha has a valid cognizer being, that he's reliable. Yeah, going through these reasonings, and I explained them extensively in the morning. During the second section, it's the other way around. Still, valid cognizer is being proven, that's what we're getting at, but then we start, during this section, we first establish protector, Buddha as a protector, teaches living beings the Four Noble Truths. Of course, the understanding of the Four Noble Truths is here now requirement, and it is presented during the second section. The Four Noble Truths are presented first, and the teacher, the Buddha, or his emanations teaching those, establish the protector. Being a protector then establishes that the Buddha has pure realizations, pure eliminations or cessations. So the Sugata is established. Sugata then establishes that previous to becoming a Buddha, the Buddha realized selflessness. And then having realized selflessness, that establishes that, well, the Buddha did so in order to benefit sentient beings. In other words, one establishes great compassion after having established that the Buddha has the realization of selflessness. So in those two ways, the Buddha being reliable is being established by using, well, these other four factors. Great compassion, the realization of selflessness, the eliminations and cessations of the Buddha, and the Buddha being a protector. So let's look at this now more closely. Let's look at these points, these stages, in the same way that they are presented. So during the first section, what is the first thing that is in general explained? What is the first idea of the five? Being a valid cognizer being. What is valid cognition? First question, right? When I say the Buddha is reliable, which is just another way of saying the Buddha is a valid cognizer being, which is another way of saying the Buddha teaches according to people's needs, aspirations, predispositions, etc. The Buddha teaches effortlessly, and the Buddha teaches from his own, through his own power, not depending on another teaching, not depending on another teacher, on the basis of, or based on the teachings of which the Buddha then presents the Four Noble Truths and so forth. No, it comes through the power of the Buddha himself. So that means that the Buddha is a reliable being, a reliable refuge, very important. I mean, part of this idea we need to defend on the Buddha is, of course, we take refuge in the Buddha, we rely on the Buddha, we depend, we have faith. Faith that his teachings will benefit us, okay? Having realized that the Buddha is reliable. Okay, so now going through each of those, going through the valid cognizer being, therefore the first of the five factors during the first section, what is a valid cognition? What does that mean? The Buddha is not a valid cognition, even though sometimes it says the Buddha is a valid cognizer or is a valid cognition. It is just using that term, but it doesn't literally mean that the Buddha is a valid cognition. Why not? Because a valid cognizer or a valid cognition is a consciousness. The Buddha has consciousness, but the Buddha is not a consciousness. That's an important distinction. So the Buddha is a living being who possesses a consciousness, possesses a body, depending on the different emanations the Buddha manifests and so forth. So the Buddha is not consciousness, but has a valid cognition. What is a valid cognition? The definition of a valid cognition or a valid cognizer of that type of mind is a knower that is newly non-deceptive, or as it's sometimes described, newly incontrovertible. I've used the word incontrovertible before when I spoke about knowing something incontrovertibly, as in like no doubt, knowing 100%. But the word incontrovertible, or the word in Tibetan, here, Sado Milubhajigpa. The definition in Tibetan is Sado Milubhajigpa. So, Sado Milubhajigpa, the end, the last word is Rigpa, which means knower. Which basically a knower, a consciousness is a knower. Any type of awareness is called a knower, not because it necessarily knows, but because it has the potential to know. Any mind has the potential to know. So therefore, any awareness is called a knower. Okay, so knower, it's a knower. Some people translate Rigpa as in like being aware, but actually Rigpa, as it, when it's used as a verb, it means to know. Okay, so it's an awareness, it's a knower, it's a type of consciousness which is newly non-deceptive. Newly, that's In this context here, according to the philosophical tenet system that is addressed here, that is mainly addressed, it talks about a new perception, and that's fine. Looking at it from that perspective, that's fine. So it's newly non-deceptive. That's the Satantrika description of a valid cognizer, and we go along with that because there's only minor differences between the Prasangika and the explanations that are given here. So there's some specific differences, of course, but they're not even presented here. So there's no reason to actually explain the Prasangika system, explain this school, this text from the point of view of the Prasangika. It works just as well with the Satantrika. So here, a valid cognizer is a mind that is non-deceptive. I use the word non-deceptive, which means milua in Tibetan. Lua means to deceive. The verb is like to deceive. It means fraudulent, to deceive. And there is, of course, a description of conventional truth as being deceptive. If you learned about the ultimate and the conventional truth, the two truth, you use the word conventional truth are milua. Lua, which means they are deceptive. They're deceptive because they appear to exist intrinsically to a direct perception, but they don't exist that way. So they appear to exist intrinsically, but they don't exist that way. Anyway, that's a totally different topic we don't need to go into. But that's why I use the word milua, the Tibetan word milua. I translate it as non-deceptive because the word is used to describe conventional truth, saying conventional truth are deceptive. Ultimate truth is non-deceptive. Conventional truth is deceptive. It is the same word. So I like to use the same word in English in all aspects and not use different words when actually the same word is used in Tibetan. As much as I can, I try to stick with these words. And to say that all conventional truths are controvertible doesn't make sense. Controvertible, incontrovertible, you can't use that. So therefore, deceptive and non-deceptive, the negative works well. Valid cognizer is non-deceptive, whereas a wrong consciousness, a mind that doesn't perceive its object correctly, a wrong consciousness is a deceptive. It's deceptive. It's deceived. Deceptive in the sense, well, it is deceptive in the sense that we think certain things exist because of that wrong consciousness. So it deceives us, okay? Deceives other perceptions. So therefore, deceptive, non-deceptive. I don't know if that's a good translation or not. But anyway, so a valid cognizer is a mind that is newly non-deceptive. Non-deceptive here seems to imply it's just a correct mind, but it has more of it, has a greater meaning than that. Not only is it a correct mind that is not deceived by anything, that is non-deceptive, on top of that, it understands, it realizes its object. It knows its object. And it knows it newly. So it newly realizes its object. Here, the Tibetan word is an adjective, sadu, sadu. Sar means new, du kind of makes an adjective. Adjective. It's newly non-deceptive. All right, so it's a knower that is newly non-deceptive. Newly, what does newly mean? This is an interesting idea in Buddhism that is stressed more in the lower systems, not so much in the Prasangika, but still exists. The idea is that when you understand something for the first time, there's a new, fresh perception. And then anytime we understand something, anytime we realize something, it's a continuum of mind. If there's only a very brief moment of a perception, if that's too short, the mind can't take anything in. When you go like that, right? Oh, sorry. That was just the perfect one. Wonder what that picture looks like. You know, when you go like that, there's not enough time to take anything in. Not enough time, right? So you need some time, even you need to face the object for long enough for your eye consciousness to be able to take in the object, because with the eye consciousness, you can only perceive what's in the sphere of your vision and what exists in the present. And of course, your eye sense power has to be directed. Well, it has to be in the sphere of your vision, so you have, it has to be turned in that direction in order for you to be able to perceive this object there. And it has to be a certain amount of time we have to spend with the object. And usually, a few moments, I mean, however long those moments are, a moment is totally relative. You could have a second and call that a moment. You can even talk about a minute a moment. So that's different, but there's a certain amount of time, and that probably depends on the person, that we have to stay with the object. And during those times, there's always a new perception and a subsequent perception. So you newly perceive it. So let's say, I don't know, however long that moment is, when you newly perceive something, and then the next moment, you perceive it due to the power of the former moment. So that implies that the new perception means it is not through the power of a previous moment. It's not through the power of a previous moment. It's like a fresh perception in that sense. So you may then say, okay, if I look in this direction, I look away, and I look again, the second time I look in that direction, is that a new perception or not? And we would say yes, because it's newly again perceived. It did not, whether I've seen this object a minute ago or I didn't, doesn't make any difference from the point of view of the second time looking in this direction. Because all the conditions for perception are there. I have the eye sense power, the light is correct, you know, the external circumstances, the object is clearly perceivable, it's there in the presence, it is in the sphere of my vision. There's a consciousness that has the ability to perceive. So all the conditions are there, therefore I perceive this object. Whether I've perceived it a minute ago or not, that is not relevant. There's again a perception through the power of those causes and conditions and not through my previous perception. Therefore, the first moment, however long that moment is, we call a new perception. Right? But the moment that perception is now not independent, has arisen, first there's an independent arising of that perception, dependent on just the causes and conditions, not on a former moment. But then at some point, it's not just the causes and conditions that come together, but it's also the former moment that is responsible for then continuing to see that. I think of it like a domino stone. The first time, it's like your finger moves it over, kicks it over. So it's not dependent on a former moment of a domino stone. But then the second stone falls over because of the first moment, and the third stone because of the first and the second moment. So that reminds me of like a subsequent cognition, which is the former moment enables us to have those later perceptions, right? And it's the very first moment is through the force of the finger, which is like just the causes and conditions. It's independent on a former stone. So here, the first moment of a perception is independent of a former moment. And there are perceptions where you have a whole continuum of just new perceptions. For example, the mind of a Buddha. It's always new. It's always fresh. Okay, or like a meditative equipoise, for those of you who know that realizes selflessness directly, for example, that is always new in each moment. So it's not an incredibly important distinction. It's not like, oh my God, you need to understand that to know the mind. It's just one of those little nitty-gritty details about consciousness. So in this context here, this fresh perception has an extra quality, newly perceiving something. Of course, there are examples when you don't newly perceive something. For example, memory. Memory. If I remember something I've done this morning, that mind arises in dependence on the mind in the morning. Right? If now I remember what I saw a few seconds ago, well, that remembering mind has arisen in dependence on the direct perception. So I have consciousnesses where even the first moment is not a new perception, like remembrance, for example. Okay? So this is just a general explanation of what is a valid cognizer here. It's a newly realizing mind. Yes, there were two questions, yes. A knower that's newly non-deceptive or newly non-deceptive knower, yeah. Yeah, an eye consciousness realizing blue, the first moment. Mm-hmm. It's not independent. It's not an independent consciousness independent of other phenomena. It's dependent on its causes. It's dependent on the blue. It's dependent on the eye sense power and so forth. But it's not dependent. It's not dependent on a mind that's previously perceived blue. It's not dependent on a mind that previously perceived blue. Mm-hmm. It could be an eye consciousness perceiving red. Yeah, it's just any mind, but it's like another mind has to precede it, but it doesn't have to be a mind that understood the same thing. So it doesn't have to be a mind that realized blue before. So for example, the second moment that realizes blue, well, there was already a perception of blue, and it just continues realizing the same thing. Remembrance is the same. I can only remember something if it's a correct memory. Well, it's something that I perceived at a different time. I mean, I had a kind of incorrect memory. I'm not talking about incorrect memory, but a correct memory of something. I saw a tree this morning, and then today, just now, I remember that tree. Well, that is, the tree is the object I had in the morning, the same tree, and now again I take it to mind, but is through the power of the mind this morning, is through the force of that, therefore it's not a newly non-deceptive mind. So it's a non-deceptive mind, it realizes its object, but it's subsequent. You had a question? So you look at it a second time, yes, okay. Yeah, and that's that. It's like you look up, you look down, you look up again. The second time is not because you did it the first time. Whether you looked at it the first time or not, you would still have that perception the second time. Whereas memory is totally dependent on the previous moment. You can't remember something if you haven't perceived it before, right? The Buddhas don't remember. There's no memory. It's just direct perception of what is there. It's not like, oh, it's happened before, lucky me. Lucky me, I got some imprints because of that, so now I can't remember. No, they don't need these imprints. They don't have those imprints. They just perceive, you know, the past, present, and future. Yes, all their lives as if it's happened right now. Not like that they have a wrong perception. It is happening right now, but it's just as clearly as this table in front of me. That perception is just as clearly. I know it's mind-boggling. It's like, I'm sometimes saying jokingly, it's almost like a blind person who's been blind since birth, trying to understand what it feels like realizing blue. You don't have the mind to do that. You've never seen blue. We're trying to theoretically get a sense what the Buddha does and does not. It's very hard to really get a sense for it, and we don't expect that. Just get a rough sense, But the answer is nonetheless the Buddha doesn't have any conceptual mind. Therefore, a memory is conceptual, but the Buddha doesn't have a conceptual mind. Yes? Okay, so this is a different question. We did that actually last night a little bit. We had this discussion about, well, what I see with my eye consciousness, I perceive blue with my eye consciousness. How can I do that if I haven't imputed, if I haven't conceptually? Well, yeah, that's what we do as children. Our eye consciousness can perceive this is a table, but only because our conceptual consciousness previously imputed. We talked about this yesterday. As children, we have a sense there's an objective world out there, as if what I see, everyone else perceives. We don't remember that when we were children. We didn't see any of that. It was because we categorized the world, we were taught ideas, we were able to see shadows over other objects so that we can see three-dimensional now. That was a process of learning. But that doesn't mean that the eye consciousness in itself is conceptual, but it's influenced by a conceptual mind. That's all right. It is not a conceptual mind. It's a direct experience, which is very much influenced by a conceptual experience. I mean, we also discussed this yesterday. When you're very, 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 very sad, and you walk out of the building, the London blue sky seems gray. So there's a conceptual mind that influences the perception. We are terribly happy. You know, I usually take the example, when people are new in love, everything tastes better, everything smells better, everything looks brighter. It's not that anything has changed, but the conceptual mind has influenced our perception. But that does not make them the same type of mind. It's a conceptual mind as opposed to a direct perceiver. But they can influence one another. Emptiness. Okay, very good question. How can you realize that you realize emptiness? How can you know you've realized emptiness? Well, I think one good clue, one reliable clue is you're a different person. You're pretty much a different person. When you've understood emptiness, the person who's realized emptiness, I mean, attachment lessens, anger lessens. Those different afflictions, I mean, you've just given a major push to the mind that grasps onto inherent existence by realizing selflessness. So I think a person who's realized selflessness, you know, sometimes I meet people, I think I just realized selflessness. You know, they think, and they say so, and that's fine. But if they've not dramatically changed, then I'm not sure. It was not nothingness. It could have been nothingness. So first of all, you check with your teacher, right? Oftentimes you just go to a teacher and you check with them. That's why the teacher is so important at all times, right? I mean, if you're at this stage, you may want to go and see, and it doesn't have to be your root teacher. It could be someone who's qualified enough, and to discuss it with them if you have any doubt. You may not have totally realized it, but on the way there, and you just need that cue maybe from a teacher. At a certain level, then you want to check with someone, okay? And so when you do that, then they can tell you, well, look at this, concentrate on this. Or they tell you, sorry, it was just nothingness. Just start, continue doing it. So that is like, that's a way. But actually studying is good. Studying, knowing exactly what are the consequences if you realize selflessness. What is the profound effect on your life? And check whether that effect has taken place, right? Check your life. I mean, that's a life-saving, life-changing experience, a very profound life-changing experience. And when you arise from it, things are like illusions, especially a direct experience. Everything is like illusion-like. Do we have that sense? Is it illusion-like? Or does it seem just as solid as before? Yeah, so there are ways of checking. Okay.
What is time, especially to the what is time? He sees everything in the past, in the future, or in the present, and understands that it's past.
Okay.
Will we use it as kind of measurement?
But the measurement is still the same. Things just change just as, you know, yesterday becomes, tomorrow becomes today. And today becomes yesterday. And for the Buddha, that's true.
Is it something separate
to the conventional and ultimate truth? No, it's conventionally, there's time. We measure time in dependence on the change. So whether you realize the change or you don't, change still takes place. For the Buddha, time doesn't stop. Time doesn't stand still. And it's not like because he realizes all three times that the present and the past and the future all become one time. No. Yesterday becomes, tomorrow becomes today. So even though the Buddha realizes what's going to happen tomorrow, but when he realizes it today, then what he realizes is tomorrow from the perspective of where he's standing right now. Whereas then tomorrow, when he realizes the same thing, the difference is now that it's become today. It's become the presence. So what used to be the future becomes the presence. That's also part of the Pramanavartika, that is description. The question is, does the Buddha's mind change? Someone would say, no, it doesn't change, because the object doesn't change. The Buddha always perceives all phenomena, right? Not to say that they do not change moment by moment, but the Buddha perceives each and every one of them at all times. It's not like we perceive something tomorrow we haven't perceived yet, okay? Yesterday we forget. So we pretty much know new things every moment, and so therefore we can say our mind changes. There's things we don't know yet because they haven't happened yet. There are other things we've forgotten because they did happen long ago. For the Buddha, that doesn't happen. The Buddha realizes everything that has ever existed exists right now and will exist in the future. That's what it means to be omniscient. So Dina's question is, therefore, does that mean there is no time, first of all, because it's all, how does the Buddha know this is past, present, future, if it's all always known? And then the question that is posited in the scriptures is, how can we say the Buddha's mind changes? Right? We say because of different objects taken to mind, our mind changes. How can we say the Buddha's mental consciousness actually changes moment by moment, not into something totally different, but there's still change? Well, if the object doesn't change, well, it does, right? Today's, tomorrow's table, when the Buddha realizes it now, it's tomorrow's table. Buddha realizes it as being tomorrow's table. Then tomorrow, when the Buddha realizes the same table, the Buddha realizes it as the present table. And then a day later, as the past table. So the objects do change as being in terms of the time. So you see? Anyway, we need to go on a little bit further. I'm sure you have lots of questions. But that, of course, is then maybe an incentive to join one of the study groups by Geshe Graham, for example, and then get more answers to those questions for those of you who haven't joined those groups yet. Okay. These are all addressed. I mean, these points are all addressed, really, in the traditional study. But returning to, okay, so the valid cognizer being. The Buddha has a valid cognizer, had lots of valid cognizers that newly realized their objects in each moment. And so that's another reason, possessing those valid cognizers at all times, we could also say the Buddha is therefore a valid cognizer being. That's more direct with regard to the term. Okay? All right, so that's the valid cognizer being. That is what we're trying to prove. So that should suffice for now, saying, you know, about valid cognizer being. We spoke about it during the first session very extensively. That's reliable, teaches spontaneously, and so forth. That's all what it means to be a valid cognizer being or to be reliable. But then great compassion. That's the next point. What is great compassion? How do you prove the existence of great compassion? What is special about great compassion as opposed to other states of mind? Can it expand? Can it expand to a great degree? Is it limited? Questions that may arise. So one thing, usually the way it's described is that, first of all, any kind of artificial compassion can become spontaneous and real compassion because it has a stable basis and does not depend on repeated, concerted effort once one is familiar with it. That's usually the way one describes compassion. We have artificial compassion, we have real compassion. Artificial compassion sounds a little weird. It sounds like as if it wasn't compassion. It is a type of compassion. But any mind, like bodhicitta is a good example. Bodhicitta is the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. Can you generate this wish right now? Think, may I become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings? You can all think that. Is that bodhicitta then? Even though it's defined as that mind, it's defined as that, but there's something extra. It's a mind that arises effortlessly. In the sense that right now, if I want it to arise, I have to kind of sit down and go, all right, I really want this. And I have to spend a few moments making an effort, meditating, in order for it to arise, right? Initially, it's like that. If His Holiness the Dalai Lama gives the Bodhisattva vow, he always spends some time to inspire people to generate bodhicitta. If someone is already a bodhisattva, you don't need to do that. All you need to do is say, generate bodhicitta, and it goes, bang, it's there. They're so familiar with it. 7-point mind training, exchanging self for others, don't need that any longer. It pops up naturally at any time, right? It pops up, for lack of a better word. It just arises all the time. So just one little trigger, think of bodhicitta, and it's there. For us, it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. We need to make an effort. We need to generate, to really feel this love, this deep care. May I be a Buddha for all sentient beings? We need to at least take a few moments. And secondly, it doesn't govern our entire life. You see, when you have bodhicitta, when you have the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings, not only for it to arise, you could see a fly and it's there. Anything can trigger it, and it's triggered all day through, so it rises spontaneously. But not just that, even when it lies latent, when it lies dormant, it governs all your actions. That's your motivating force. Whatever you do for that. Does that make sense? So it's like, it's hard to describe, but right now, maybe the best way to describe it, my self-grasping mind is not always there. Not always there. Sometimes it lies latent. But everything I do is because of that. My self-grasping mind governs each of my actions. It is very, very, very rare, and then also very, very brief, that I do something that is not in one way or another governed by the self-grasping mind. So here, a bodhisattva is someone who's put that to the back burner, if you like. It's kind of not eliminated it, but it's weakened it by strengthening the wish to be there for the benefit of all sentient beings, the wish to make others happy. Right? That's before bodhicitta, actually. So the wish for all sentient beings to be free from suffering, that then leads to bodhicitta. And once that is sincere, it is this non-artificial in the sense that it arises spontaneously and it governs that person's life. It controls that person's life. So if you want to know whether you have bodhicitta or not, check. It's not that hard, right? It's easy to check in a way. I mean, again, if you wonder, do I have bodhicitta? But just thinking every now and then, I actually have a friend, and she doesn't mean it. She's not that. She thinks she's not full of herself or anything. She's a very humble person. But she thought to be a bodhisattva means every now and then you wish to be enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. So she said, I'm a bodhisattva. One day she told me. I was like, what? It's like, yeah, every now and then I wish to become a Buddha, therefore I'm a bodhisattva. But that's not what it means. This mind is a mind that is so deep and so powerful such that it's always near the surface. If it's not on the surface, if it's not manifestly there, anything can trigger it very easily, and all one's actions are governed by that. I mean, there are some selfish actions, maybe every now and then, surely, because they're still self-grasping, but they are very minor. Mainly one works for the benefit of others. Mainly one's life is not the happiness of this lifetime. No, that's gone. I don't care about the happiness of this lifetime. Maybe a tiny moment, but in the long run, it is others. It's others. So that is called uncontrived bodhicitta, as opposed to contrived. So you have the same with great compassion. First, it's artificial. First is when one tries hard, and that's great. One needs to have artificial or contrived great compassion before the real deal. But once one has the real deal, it gets strengthened and strengthened and strengthened until at some point it just arises spontaneously all the time. It's like it fills one's entire body. It fills like one's heart, just that others, absence of suffering. The absence of suffering of other sentient beings, wishing for that, right? That's great compassion. All right, so we talk about contrived and uncontrived. I think the difference is clear here. So what is great compassion? It's said to have a stable basis. What does that mean? And once one is familiar with it, one doesn't depend on repeated concerted effort. That's exactly that spontaneity, that is the spontaneous aspect of it. But a stable basis. So this takes us to the idea that great compassion can grow limitlessly. Whereas there are certain actions, especially physical actions, they cannot grow limitlessly. Can you give me an example of something that physically cannot grow limitlessly, cannot expand limitlessly? Pardon? Huh? Say it again. Yes, you're very good. That's a very good example. my example about becoming like, trying to become like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, if you can try to, there's a limit to. You know, you can go on and do 24 hours of weightlifting, and at some point your muscles just don't grow any further. In the scriptures, they use the example of jumping high. You can train as much, but there's a limit to how high you can jump. You won't be able to jump any higher. Then they use water. You know, if you boil water, you boil it further and further, and you make the fire even hotter, the water will turn into steam. It's not going to get hotter. There's a limit to that. So physical objects are usually limited in that way, right? Yes. Well, let's see. We're looking at this first. I just kind of compared, I said physical things. Yes. No, that's all right. Physical things, you know, they're limited in that way. Now, we're claiming that great compassion can grow limitlessly. But what does that mean, actually? So we need to really define that correctly. It's not like it grows bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and like the Buddha's compassion also grows bigger and bigger and bigger. That would mean that the Buddha's compassion can be improved, right? First day of a Buddha, compassion this big. Second day of being a Buddha, it grows even further. That's not what it means to grow limitlessly. It means something else. Well, it's like this idea that sentient beings are limitless, basically. You can't really put a number to living beings, though there are two different views on that. Limitless just means a large amount. And some say no, it means living beings are limitless. But in other words, it's not like you can limit it to this person and not any further. It's like towards anyone. It's expansive in the sense that you start off with like one person, maybe just yourself, and family, friends, but eventually it's like it's all encompassing. in terms of sentient beings. That's what it means, like it's limitless, right? It's that sense of limitlessness that we need to look at its object. What is its object? Whatever suffering there is, one wants that suffering to be removed. So suffering comes along with living beings, so therefore it encompasses all living beings. That's the sense of limitlessness. Now, I have a few debates here. A few questions. All right. So, compassion can therefore grow to such an extent that you have that sense of caring and the wish for any living being to be free from suffering. Can you do that with anger? Can you take anger and be and let that grow limitlessly? What do you think? What do you think? Can you expand your anger, first of all? Can you give me an example of a state of mind where you try to expand on a state of mind that's maybe not terribly desirable, but it's still beneficial, where you expand? During Buddhist meditation, it's a part of a Buddhist meditation, where you actually try to expand a state of mind that in the long term you don't want to generate, but you try to expand it towards all sentient beings. Can you think of that type of mind? I give you a cue, I give you a clue. Before doing the meditation of exchanging self for others, equalizing and exchanging self for others, and before you do the meditation on the seven-point cause and effect method, what do you generate? Equanimity. What do you do with equanimity? What do you actually try to do? You look at three different objects. Number one, friend, very good. Friend. What are you trying to do with your feeling towards the friend? That strong, oh, they're so important for me. You try to lessen that by thinking of how they've harmed me in the past. That's probably the only time you're really thinking. When we're very attached to someone, right? When we're very strong. Usually, I kind of jokingly say that, but it's actually true. When we are with a group of people, we very quickly go, like, dislike, don't care. Like, dislike, don't care. Right? We kind of very quickly divide those people into those we like, into those we don't like, and those we don't care about. And usually the ones we like and the ones we dislike, that group is smaller. But we have that automatic kind of response. It's not that extreme. But when you spend time with a group of people, very quickly you divide them up into those you want to stay with, those you want to be with, you want to be with them when you take the bus or something. Let's say you take a trip somewhere. You know, you do bus rides together and all that. There are those you want to sit next to. You want to sit at the dinner table with. There are those that really annoy you all the time because they say things you find very annoying and whatever. And then the rest that you don't care about. That's how we usually relate to people. It's a very natural way of relating to people. It arises naturally, and then whether we follow from that, that's our decision. Right? That's up to us. But it arises naturally. So in that meditation, you try to think of someone that you feel really close to, and usually there's attachment because of the liking. They make you feel good, there's attachment. Then there are the ones you don't like. There's usually resentment, aversion. And then the ones you don't care. Then you have the kind of sense of ignorance. Just it's none of the other two. It's not really attachment. It's not so much anger. It's more of just misperception of, you know, things about them. You don't really perceive them correctly. Okay? So those are the three. So in order to get rid of those three emotions with regard to those three types of people, we try to reduce attachment. So we try to think, whoever we were close to, well, they weren't always our friends. They were also our enemies at some point. They, you know, harmed us in a way. And then there's a sense, okay, they're not these intrinsic, wonderful people at all times. It creates a distance. And then you do the same with a person you have aversion towards. Except now you think, they were not always people I disliked. They were very, very close to me. So you kind of try to create a balance. Then in the end, also with those strangers, well, sometimes they harm me. Sometimes they're close to me. There's no reason to have them as strangers. There's a balanced sense towards all sentient beings. They're pretty equal. And then from there, you generate love. Because if you have strong attachment towards someone and then you try to replace it with love, it's difficult. First, you need to create a distance. Yeah, make sure it doesn't get too much of a distance and you start, hey, no, no, a very balanced distance. And when the attachment is lessened, you can wish sincerely for them to be happy, free from suffering. And that's real love. That's real compassion. Attachment means I want them to make me happy. So that's the problem. This we need to kind of, this, we need to get some distance to that. And we do this through the meditation on equanimity, where you generate a bit of a distance towards. So it means you can actually generate those states. You could do it with all sentient beings. If you were to sit down, for whatever absurd reason, you would decide, okay, I want to hate all sentient beings now. All sentient beings, at some point, have been my sworn enemy. So I need to now repay their, what have they done to me? Okay, well, they harmed me, they cut off my limbs, they did this and that over and over. All right, so I need to now repay that harm, right? So that is, it's actually the seven point mind training, what do you call it? The six causes and one effect method, right? That causal, it's the same, but you reverse it now. So could you do that for all sentient beings? Could you do that theoretically? You could. You could. Could you hate all sentient beings? Some people. But actually, like, how abstract is that when you just go, I hate everyone? Do you really? They say that, right? They say that. I don't believe that. I think they just say it. Because they don't hate everyone. Pardon? Yeah, but even temporary, surely temporary, because at some point they become enlightened, so that state of mind. But I don't believe that they actually, literally, whoever they meet, they hate them. Because great compassion means whoever you meet, the same sense of care, the same sense of love. It's equal. You know, whoever walks in the room, can we really have that with respect to all sentient beings? And if not, why not? Can you not like some? What is your question?
I might dislike someone.
Okay.
I wish them harm. I wish them so much happiness. I wish them all the best. I wish them no suffering. I wish them happiness. But I dislike them. I find them. Isn't that?
That's a good. You dislike them. Why do you dislike them?
I find them annoying.
So you think everything about them is annoying?
Not everything.
Okay. Not everything. So you think there's something positive about them? So you could choose that good part and like that, and take the annoying part and dislike that. You see, this is what dislike does. It takes just one aspect. This is really the cue, really. I mean, this is where anger, aversion, dislike, it's not in accordance with reality. It's not in accordance with reality. When we don't like someone, all we see is an annoying part, and we add a little bit more of annoyance to it, as if like, we exaggerate. As long as the Dalai Lama usually says, he cites a psychotherapist called Aaron Beck, and says that Aaron Beck has told him, according to modern psychology, that every time there's anger, and this is like a dislike, it's a type of aversion or anger. It's not the coarse kind of anger, but it's a type of anger. It's 90% of projection. Pardon? It's called cognitive fusion. So that's what it's called? Modern psychology, I mean, yeah. Ah, he uses that phrase, okay. Right, okay. So this is another point. I mean, this is not just, okay, that's cognitive fusion in the sense, okay, I understand what you mean. Like the qualities that we dislike in a person, seeing that person as one with the person. So it's not just the action, it's also character traits. Okay, that's one aspect. But not just that. Not only do we see that, not only do we see these characteristics as like being the same as the person, moreover, we take just one character trait and focus on that, and we see it as more negative than it actually is. Because if we all saw it in the same way, if we saw it objectively the way it was, everyone would see that annoyance in the same way. And, you know, this person's mom would have a really hard time liking them, right? Because they would recognize that same annoyance, yeah? Because it's right there objectively from the side of the object. and have the same reaction. So it shows we add something to it, because otherwise everyone would see that person in the same way. So it's very much created by the mind. We add. So when you dislike someone, and I'm not saying it's just you, I'm exactly in the same position. So when you dislike someone, it's like one focuses on just one aspect and forgets the rest. Even if you know that is not the person, even if you didn't have cognitive fusion, if you didn't have that problem, you would still focus more on a negative trait, and it totally overwhelms you. But of course, on top of that, you also don't think that the person is anything other than just that, which means there is no space for any other trait. So that's showing that anger is not based on reality. Attachment is not based on reality, right? I mean, I said that last night when we got together. I say all the time, when we're infatuated with someone, when we're in love with someone. I gave the example when I was in high school. Even the backpack of that person was more beautiful than everyone else's was. So it's like the glow of that person extends to the backpack. And then, as I said, also, I keep saying the same example, but it works with these extreme examples because they illustrate this in the most effective way. If then we don't get together with that person, right? We're kind of fantasizing for month and month, and then somehow they go to a different school, I go to a different school, and I happen to meet them again after a year, what's my first thought? What was I thinking? What did I see in that person, right? How often did that happen? I mean, growing up, you know, when the hormones went totally wild. It shows in that moment when the attachment, the infatuation was there, our mind just adds all these incredible negativities, right? When we fight with our partners, I mean, oftentimes we have more hatred towards our partner than we could ever have towards the bus driver, who we don't know, right? So in that moment, we just see them as so negative. And all they need to say, sorry, let's go. Oh, it's not so bad. It's not so bad, don't worry, right? I mean, it's just how our mind works. It's not rational. But these afflictions, these different emotions, the moment they arise, you need to watch them. They start exaggerating. Arrogance. Oh, one tiny quality, right? One tiny quality that I have. I blow it up, right? I think, oh my God, it's so amazing. Someone else would say, what's the big deal? But I feel so full about, you know? That's how arrogance works. Or jealousy. Another person's quality. I blow it up. Oh my God, that's the only thing that's worth living for. And I don't have it. They have it. Bloody hell, you know, how can I get it? So that's jealousy. So it's always exaggerating, not seeing the whole picture, and then reacting accordingly. So therefore, I've already given it away. Great compassion is based on reality. It's rooted in reality. Love and compassion are rooted in reality. They make sense. You take the teaching on emptiness, dependent arising. Usually we take teaching and dependent arising to explain love and compassion. That makes sense. Whereas anger is the opposite. It's not rooted in reality. So one has a stable basis and the other one doesn't. So it's very difficult for it to expand. Theoretically, you could, but I don't think you could actually always maintain that. I don't think, because there's no stable basis. Eventually, our intelligence is going to catch up with us. And we're like, come on, they're not that bad. Right? It's just in the spur of the moment we may get really angry and see it as negative. And we may have that with one person. But we will often find when we have anger towards one person, we just want to patch up things. It's just so tiring. We just don't want to have trouble with the rest. Because it's tiring, it's exhaustive, and it's not what we want, and it's really not being based on reality. So that we need to recognize, that not only is the misperception of reality not based on reality, no, moreover, whatever this misperception induces is not in accordance with reality. It's always a wrong consciousness. Its object never exists. And when I'm angry with you, it's so bizarre. If you think about it, when I'm angry with you, I love Chantideva's example. The stick, right? The stick, you're not angry with the stick. When you beat me up, I'm not angry with the stick. Why? Because the stick is under the control of the person. But what am I angry with? With you. But you're under the control of your anger. I wouldn't be angry with your anger. Let's say you really get angry and you harm me badly. I never get angry with your anger. So not only am I getting angry with the thing that doesn't harm me, I get angry with a Dino that doesn't exist. I get angry with the Dino that doesn't even exist. An intrinsic Dino-ness. It's not his face, it's not his body, it's not his anger. It's a Dino-ness. Right? A Dino-ness, right? It's something, some essence there. Something that is not, it's none of the parts. If you were to say, is it his nose? No. Is it his face? No. It's none of those things. It's something separate. So not only do I exaggerate, you know, Dino-ness, annoyingness, right? On top of it, I don't get angry with that annoyingness, actually, by the way, but this annoying quality, I don't get angry with that. I then create another Dino that is somehow, well, the same in a way, and then not again the same. Inexpressible, of course, because it doesn't exist. And then I get angry with that. I mean, really, what's your anger? It's amazing. It's amazing, the anger. It doesn't. None of its objects actually exist. I'm not even getting angry with Dino. Because Dino is imputed on the basis of his mind and body, so I'm not even getting angry on a merely imputed person. An intrinsic Dino-ness. Right? That's what I, Dino-ness, that's what I get angry with. So these afflictions, they're never rooted in reality. They're totally, we need to recognize that. We need to really recognize that. Then we can understand their harmfulness a little better. Harmfulness a little better, right? Okay, moving away from that. So great compassion, therefore, is rooted in reality. It makes sense. Yeah, can't go into all the reasonings, unfortunately, but just the sense that all sentient beings are just like myself, right? Every living being is just like myself. They want to be happy. And I deserve to be happy, and so do others. So, I'm just as equally important as they are. Why would my happiness be more important? Therefore, I wish for all sentient beings to have happiness. Right? And since they outnumber me, well, then that's actually more important. In terms of numbers, they're more important. And my selfishness has always just has only ever harmed me, has only ever given me headaches and trouble. So there are a lot of good reasons to now replace it, and it's all rooted in reality. So great compassion, what do we need to know about it? It has a stable basis. It is rooted in reality, and it can expand towards all living beings. These are very important qualities. That's great compassion, okay? All right, so the first state of mind, to get an understanding of that, and we can generate that. You can start with your friends, you can expand it, and by doing these practices, you can get a first-hand experience of how your compassion can at least be expanded. And with Buddhist practice, your sense of compassion may have been very limited, and then with Buddhist practice, you may actually find yourself, you can love the annoying person. What a surprise. Right? You still think, it's impossible to ever, and suddenly you can see your mind changing and becoming softer towards that person, becoming more tolerant. That's the first step. And there's real change, and that is convincing in the sense, wow, I can expand my compassion towards that annoying person. And then even further and further. And on the basis of that, one can come to an understanding, one can infer it's possible on the basis, focused on all sentient beings, I can generate the wish for all living beings to be free from suffering. That would mean one understands the existence of great compassion. Okay, does that make sense? Now, selflessness. The mind that realizes selflessness. What is that mind? The mind that realizes selflessness. Is it going to 3:30, right? The section is up to 3:30. Okay. Selflessness. Does selflessness exist or not? Just a few reasonings. And you know many of these reasonings, so I'm just repeating them, but they're just so effective. Anything we investigate, so if we want to understand the mind that realizes selflessness based on great compassion, we need to know something about selflessness. What does that actually mean? How do phenomena exist? It's a very important part of our Buddhist practice. We should never lose sight of the idea of selflessness. So with the self itself, of course, is very effective. What is the self? Is there a sense it's located somewhere in the body, physically, as if it was located somewhere? Have you ever asked yourself that? Is there a sense? I used to think it was the same for everyone. For me, there's the sense myself is behind my eyes. And I used to think everyone else had the same sense of the self. And that, as it turned out, well, some people say, no, it feels like as if it was in the heart. Some say it's like in the brain. I don't think anyone ever thinks it's in your kneecap. Right? So there's always a sense like the heart, the belly, the brain, you know, some part around here. Never in the limbs, really, right? The arms and legs. Okay, so there's a sense it's located somewhere. Definitely we will have that sense. That already gets us in touch. And there's a sense of sometimes a permanent self. Sometimes we have a sense that the self is permanent, whereas mind and body, we don't have that sense with regard to mind and body. That's a coarser expression of a sense of a self. So usually I say, think of the sense of a self the moment you sit down to have lunch up until now. Is there a sense that's the same self all the way through, from the self that was eating up until now? Or the self that came into this room at around, what was it, 2 o'clock? Came into this room at 2 o'clock until now. The sense that there's the same self. Your body has changed, your mind has changed, but the self is the same. Do you have that sense? Right? No sense that the self is the same? Right? A sense of like there's something there that was there the whole time. Okay. Anyway, so then where's that self? Is it one with the body? Is it separate from the body? The flower. There's a flower there, right? A flower that has parts. Would you agree? There's a flower that has parts. We talk about the flower, the petals of the flower. So there's an owner of those petals. There is a flower there that owns the flower petals, that owns the stem, that owns the leaves. That sense of a flower, there's some flowerness over there. Right? We have a sense of that. It's difficult to get in touch with that because it's more of an innate sense. Usually I like to talk about people who give their cars names. Some people name their cars as if it had a certain character, a personality. Ooh, my car is a little grumpy today. It just won't, you know. It's if there was really something there. I think cartoons are based on that sense. You know, walking cupboards, fighting chairs, right? It's the sense there is some innate, some character, almost like a consciousness there. Trees, things we love. It seems they smile at us, right? Our house protects us. Oh, our house is very kind. There's a sense, there's some essence there. And it's not the roof. It's not the walls. It's something separate than that. There's that sense sometimes, not at all times. And then if that was really the case, we could remove, if the plant really existed, the flower existed that way, well, it would be possible to remove the parts and still be left for the plant, right? Or still be left with the flower. Also, it wouldn't make sense to say the flower changes when really all it changes are its parts. So to say that this flower is different from its parts doesn't work. I think we'd all agree. Same with a self. There is a strong sense of a self that I call the owner of my mind, that which thinks, that which meditates, that which controls the mind. Okay, I say, I control the mind. So there's an I, that's not the mind. Right? It's the control of the mind. It's separate from the mind. I control my body movements. All right, that's not the body. That's the owner of the body, right? So we talk along those lines. We use that kind of language. And due to the sense of a separate self, it gets strengthened in the sense that, oh, there's a separate self. Like when my legs walk, some invisible sense is being picked up and walk together, right? I walk, not just my legs. It's not just because my legs walk, I walk. No, I walk. I, something separate. So if that was separate from mind and body, you could remove mind and body and be left with it. Now, I ask people usually, well, then if it doesn't exist separate, well, is it one with mind and body? And there's a typical answer, but usually when I say, well, if it's one with mind and body are plural. The self is just one. So then you have a problem there. Either you just have one part because you just have one self, or you have many selves. Because there are many parts. So then a lot of Westerners say, no, it's not one. It's also not separate. So what is the self? What do people say? When I say, do you see the flower? Do you actually see the flower? Do you see the flower, everyone? Actually, you see something that is not the flower. Actually, you see something that's not the flower. You see this front part, that's not the flower. Right? That's that front part, that blossom, that's not the flower. The flower? What does the flower refer to? What is the flower? Pardon? isn't that all of it? It's the collection of parts, right? The flower? Wouldn't you say the flower is, well, either the flower is all of its parts or none of its parts. We can't say it's some of its parts, right? Would you agree? Okay. So therefore, can we say, I see the flower? No one sees the flower because you never see the entirety of the flower. Uh-huh. Okay, so she doesn't see the flower. She sees the shape and color of a part which is not the flower. Right? So, like, this is our sense of reality. I mean, there's a sense this is the flower. A lot of people say the flower is the collection of the parts. It's all of the parts. But then if we see the flower, we have to see all of the parts. If the car is the collection of all its parts, assembled in a certain way, of course, then if the car breaks down, all of the parts have to break down. Also, then no one would have ever been to London. Because London refers to everything that makes up London. Who can be in all of, who has ever been in all places of London? Impossible. How can we say, I've been to London? How can I say I've visited? How can I say I am in London? Because I'm not in the whole, I'm not in the collection of London. So the person is not the collection of the parts. It's not separate from the parts. It's not one with the parts. It's not even all the parts. It's not all the parts. Right? So what is the person? What is London? Well, label is not London. Label comes from here. I know that was the next thing. That's, we say it's label. What does that mean? London is the label. Well, the label is a name, but London is not a name. It's a city. I mean, it refers to something. I'm not just talking about the word. London, forest, flower. What is it? How can I say the flower exists? What is it? Okay, so you say, you know, someone exists. You say so-and-so exists. You say this is a forest, right? It's not just the manner of speaking. Those people who don't speak, who can't speak, living beings who can't speak, they still have a sense, this is that. They may not use the language, right? Before you learned how to read and write, before you learned to speak, you had a sense of reality. I mean, you had a sense of this is that. Right? So what does it actually mean the flower exists? What does it actually mean I exist? Is there a sense, you see, what I'm trying to create here, and I have very little time, so if I had a little bit more time, I could just talk about that. Those 5 hours we spent together today, we can just talk about that. What I tried to do is, we have a very strong sense of reality. This is that. I said before earlier, there's a sense, there's this objective reality waiting to be revealed, right? As if everyone were to see this. As if colors were actually out there. This brown is over there, and I just happen to look at it. I'm just a looking glass into the world. Not that brown is only there because I have an eye consciousness and a brain and, you know, a mind that interprets whatever signals it gets from the brain and interprets brown, because there's no brown over there. Colors are just light waves, right? So I usually say jokingly, well, if there's a tree falls over in a, we did that yesterday too, if there's a tree that falls over in a forest and there's no one there to see it, does it make a sound? Well, we don't know. If there's a tree in the forest, and let's leave aside the Buddhas. Let's not even talk about them. It's interesting, same reply. No, let's not talk about the Buddhas. Just ordinarily, there's a tree in the forest, it falls over, but there's no one there to perceive it. Does it make a sound? No, it can't make a sound. Why? Because sound is the coming together of certain external factors that then activate our eardrum, vibration is created, and sound is something an eye consciousness perceives. But the tree wouldn't be there either. Because a tree is an object that has shape and color. color only exists if there's an eye consciousness to perceive it. You wouldn't even have a tree. If there is a perceiver. A flower only exists if there is a perceiver. Now, there is a sense, what I perceive, you also perceive. But what I perceive, none of you perceive. And what you perceive, no one else perceives. So what is that reality out there? Is there some objective? Impossible. What would that be? There's just the summary. Reality is the summary of each and everyone's perception here, which is totally subjective. But that's not how it seems. That's not how it seems, and that's the main problem. There seems to be an objective world there, an objective goodness, badness. When I'm annoyed with someone, I'm never thinking, oh, that's just me. No. That person is objectively annoying. And everyone else should feel the same way. I don't understand their parents. Right? There's that sense, and that's what governs our actions. So to start looking for an object, where is it really? When we have anger, what am I angry with? And when we start looking for it, there's nothing there. Even if I were to anger with your anger, what is the anger? It's moments of perceptions on the basis of which I say anger. That's it. No anger to be found. If you left aside that idea of anger, if that wasn't there, you wouldn't have anger. So when we say label, it's not so much the word, it's just the idea we have. There's a forest because we have an idea of a forest. Without the idea, you wouldn't have a forest. So it's all created by the mind. It's not mind only. Mind only is a little different. But we never move away from the mind only school as much as we may want to. It's all a creation of our own mind. And our own mind is a creation of our own mind. So it goes endlessly. There's nothing to be really found. So that sense of like things start disappearing, right? It kind of gets loosened. Like, oh my God, all my worries. Where's the worry? Where's the cause of the worry? Right? Previously. I mean, just think of any kind of worry and start looking at what I'm really worried about. That disappears. And if I'm worried about my worry, well, then just look at the worry itself. That starts disappearing. So the point is to just undo this sense of, get an understanding of how phenomena do not exist as they appear and how that perception is responsible for our afflictions. That's really important to understand. We need to make that connection. If you have worry, if there's any worry, this is, I think, a good example. It's a good time to start asking yourself, why am I unhappy? And before long, you find affliction. Unhappy because I'm jealous and I don't get what I want. Unhappy because I'm angry because someone harmed me. Unhappy because I'm attached to something and I don't get what I want. Or I'm worried about losing what I like so much. So there's so many reasons. When there's some unhappiness, there's an affliction somewhere. And then when you find the affliction that is responsible. And of course, understand, the affliction is not you. Just in that moment, there is an affliction that's there. That leads to an awareness that is unhappy. Then look a little further. How do I perceive? What is the focus of that affliction? A person that I'm attached to? Is there a sense that there's an intrinsically good person there, and that's why I'm attached to him or her? Or an intrinsically existing negative person, annoying person, that I therefore have then anger towards. There's always, and it's not just the sense I exist intrinsically and inherently, and the other person does. No, everything about them, everything they say, my relationship with them, everything seems to be objectively, intrinsically existence. It's very complicated. And our mind, just before those afflictions arise, perceives one or the other as being inherently existent. So when you come to understand that, you come to see that the culprit is the mind that perceives intrinsic existence. We're totally caught in that perception. And of course, it doesn't help that when we don't actively perceive phenomena to be intrinsically existent, we don't have that active perception. They still appear to us all the time. All the time, to my eye consciousness, there seems to be an objective world out there. To my nose consciousness, my ear consciousness, as if nothing to do with my mind, there's just that objective world that I happen to discover right now or happen to perceive. And then, of course, I add onto this conceptually, and all the other afflictions arise. That understanding needs to arise understanding the real culprit is the misperception of reality. Very, very important. Because otherwise, how do we get from understanding that, well, Buddha has, before someone becomes a Buddha, he or she, during the time of being in training, have generated great compassion. And inevitably, that led to the realization of emptiness. Why? Because if there is great compassion, you want to be of greatest benefit to others. Eventually, that's, your whole life is governed by just that. And you're trying to find a solution to their problems. So what is a better solution than, well, becoming a Buddha yourself? That's the best solution. Become a Buddha yourself to lead all sentient beings there. And how can you do that? By removing what's in the way to becoming a Buddha. And that can only be done by realizing selflessness. Right? So sooner or later, someone with great compassion will generate the mind that realizes selflessness. That's the next, the understanding of the wisdom that realizes selflessness. Okay? So again, we cannot go into much more detail, but it gives you a sense here already, and the text goes into an explanation on that. Next, it goes into an explanation of, or it presents what are called eliminations and realizations. So what did I say before? Enlightenment is already here in the sense. I use the example, just as we say, this restaurant has noodle soup, even though there is no noodle soup at that point, but we say this restaurant has noodle soup because all the ingredients are there. And it's only a matter of putting them together. Likewise, we have already Buddha nature. In some traditions, they say we are already enlightened, which doesn't mean literally we are enlightened now. It means we have all the ingredients. We don't need anything from the outside. In the sense that, well, some assistance, yes, but the main ingredients we have already. We have a mental consciousness, and the afflictions, our shortcomings, are not in the nature of those. They're temporary. They can be removed if we generate the right kind of mind. So there are many different examples or many analogies for explaining how this mind is actually pure. It's like muddy water. Muddy water, it looks like the water and the mud, they've become one nature. It seems that way. That's what our mind, it seems to us. It seems, oh my God, I'm my anger. I can ever be not angry because anger rises so frequently and so strongly. How could I ever even just lessen that, let alone totally remove it? But it's like mud. It's H2O and the mud, they have never mixed. You can actually, through a chemical process, remove the mud, whatever makes the mud particles, and still have H. So they've never really mixed, they've never become one. So likewise with anger, likewise with these obstructions. And that's the idea, that the mind is actually pure. That's the ingredient. Plus, it lacks inherent existence. It doesn't exist objectively, intrinsically, which would mean we could never change it. If the mind existed the way it appears to us, this intrinsic, objective entity, if it really existed that way, it would be independent of anything else. It would be static. We could not change it. So the fact that the mind lacks inherent existence, plus the mind itself, that's what we mean with Buddha nature. Both of them, they're just different ways of talking about Buddha nature, having Buddha nature. Having this mental consciousness, and the fact that this mental consciousness exists as a non-inherently existent entity that can therefore be changed, can be transformed. Okay. So, therefore, if there's great compassion, it's the incentive to do something. And there's the antidote, the mind that realizes selflessness, before sooner or later, one is able to remove what's in the way. So if you remove what's in the way, I like to use the example of a flower bud. Which is interesting because the English word bud, B-U-D, apparently, when I talked about this yesterday too, it has the same root in Sanskrit as the bud, B-U-D of Buddha. So it has that connotation, like the bud, the flower bud, but it's like the flower is within. You don't need to add some color or some shape from the outside. No, it's all in there, but it's restricted by whatever skin that holds that bud together. So if you remove the bud, you're left with what's inside, and those are the realizations of a Buddha. So becoming omniscient, it's not the process of becoming omniscient, it's not about gaining more knowledge, right? Like becoming bodhisattva, and then as a bodhisattva, you add more knowledge until you realize all phenomena. Maybe a sense of that's how it works. No. It's just removing what is in the way of knowing all phenomena. So when the last obstacle is removed, the person may not have much knowledge just before they become a Buddha, but when the obscurations to enlightenment are removed, then automatically everything is known. And that's why in everyday life, it's actually not surprising that some people have special abilities. They're not that special, actually, in comparison to what a Buddha can do. But it gives us a glimpse into what is actually possible. So there are some people, I definitely believe there are some frauds, of course, but there are also a lot of people who have actual clairvoyance, right? They can actually realize things. And sometimes we don't listen to this inner voice, this instinctive, maybe there's some danger. We may not listen to it. We may choose not to listen to it because it may not make sense to us. But sometimes we actually know something. Oftentimes when there's a strong relationship, a mother and her child, or a father and his child, or twins and so forth. That's just big deal. That's what the mind can do. The mind is in the nature of knowing, except it's just restricted right now. And every now and then, through a premonition or, you know, through some insight, we get a glimpse of that. So it's almost like our mind is like covered. It's covered by all those obstructions, and every now and then there's a hole poked into it, and we actually have some extra kind of knowledge. And that's expressed in supernatural knowledge. It's actually not supernatural. It's actually very natural. It's what we're naturally able to do. Right now, our state is totally not natural. Anyway, so Buddha state is really the natural state. Ours is unnatural. Okay, so anyway, that therefore takes one to the understanding of sugata. Okay, so we had great compassion, one wishing to benefit migrators. The second is the teacher, which is the mind realizing selflessness. It's just giving the name teacher because that is what eventually leads us to be able to teach others. That is the kind of the vacuum cleaner, I sometimes call it. The mind realizing selflessness is the vacuum cleaner. It cleans away everything that's in the way, the obstructions. Yeah? Whereas the great compassion is the wish to do that. Wish to eliminate whatever is in the way, to wish to use the vacuum cleaner. Okay. And then you have what's called the sugata, the eliminations, and the realizations. So a few things to say about these eliminations. When one eliminates what's in the way, it is eliminated forever, for good. It cannot come back. Good news. Right? Irreversibly. Irrevocably. I mean, it won't come back. Like, no way. So once it's a that's the question that people may have. Well, if I remove my afflictions, can they come back? I don't think I would even attempt to get rid of them if I were to think they could come back. What's the point, right? If they come back all the time. If they come back once, there's no reason that they don't come back again. But removing the obstructions with a mind that realizes selflessness, one needs to understand that they can never come back. They can never come back once they're totally removed. So we are only familiar with reducing afflictions. We are familiar with reducing them. How do we reduce anger? By generating compassion or love, patience, right? Okay. How do we reduce attachment? What is an antidote to temporarily reducing? Reflecting on impermanence, for example. That's an effective antidote. But that's a little bit like we have a tree, and we try to get at the root, and we just cut the branches and the leaves a little bit to actually be able to start cutting at the root. But it's only temporary. Again, another incentive for never forget selflessness. It should always be in the back of our mind, one way or another, because that's most important. But temporarily, we try to work with these different afflictions. But what is the limitation of patience, besides the fact I cannot totally eliminate anger? What is another limitation of antidotes such as compassion or patience? Just seeing them as just merely an antidote. What is their limitation, besides the fact they can only reduce anger, for example? What's another limitation? Pardon? Okay, but in terms of serving as an antidote, how is it limited as... Yeah, that too, but what else besides that? They don't attack the root, and therefore they serve as an antidote only of... Pardon? Yes, I mean, in terms of the anger, patience can only reduce anger, right? And it cannot tackle any of the other afflictions, right? Yeah, my own, of course, but that's also my the mind that realizes selflessness, of course, can also just only deal with my own afflictions, but it can deal with all afflictions. The antidotes, there's a difference between patience, the mind realizing self, impermanence, in the sense we need to understand that they're limited and only temporarily useful. Why? Because they can only temporarily reduce the afflictions, and they can only very specifically reduce a specific affliction. So two disadvantages. Whereas the mind that realizes selflessness, not only can it totally eradicate an affliction, it can eradicate any affliction. Right? Of course, considering, I mean, of course, taken as my own, I cannot. My realization of selflessness cannot, of course, eliminate someone else's. But in terms of just my own, that's why the realization of selflessness is a must, an absolute must. So that is what how far do we get so far? Okay, so Sugata realizations and Sugata eliminations. Okay. And then next, well, protector, a Buddha. What does that mean, protector? When we say protector, well, let's just go back a little bit. Sugata realizations. What do we call Sugata realizations? What is the technical term for that? Because previously, we talked about the excellent causes of a Buddha, which are great compassion and the mind that realizes selflessness. Those are the causes. Now, with the Sugata, here we talk about the result. How do we talk about results? What is the word we use when we talk about a Buddha's result, a Buddha's quality? There's a very specific word that's used. Kaya. Right? Kaya. When we describe a Buddha, we speak of different kayas. It's a little, just, I don't even like the translation of the word kaya. What is the translation, the English translation, body? Which is, I don't like that translation, actually. It's very confusing. In Tibetan, they also use the word gu, which is an honorific term for what can be used as form, gu. But it actually means more like a quality, right? Kaya is a kind of quality. I mean, you know, Dino right now has lots of qualities, lots of attributes, lots of features. Likewise, a Buddha has lots of features. And those features, in order to describe them, we call them such and such kaya, such and such kaya. So really just qualities, attributes. Okay. So when we talk about realization of a Buddha, what does that actually mean? What is that? Of the five aggregates, what is it? Of mind and body, what is it? Which kaya is it? If you know anything about the kayas, if you're able to use the terminology, which of the kayas is it? The Dharmakaya, but more specifically, because Dharmakaya is more like the blanket term. The Jnanakaya, or the wisdom, yeah, the wisdom body, which we talk about as the mental consciousness of the Buddha. And we say the realizations, well, that refers to the mental consciousness of the Buddha. Yeah? So the realizations of a Buddha, where can they be found? Not with his body, right? Not with the sense consciousnesses, it's really the mental consciousness. The mental consciousness. And that's what we, when we talk about Buddha nature, that's what the Buddha nature. The before the Buddha became enlightened as a bodhisattva, the mental consciousness was the Buddha nature. And then when that mental consciousness is freed from whatever is in the way, we then call that the Jnanakaya, the realization of the Buddha. Right? And the mental consciousness is what defines us as a person. That's the main. The main thing that defines us as a person, of the physical and the mental, what do you think is more important? Of course, the mental, right? When we get to know someone, first there's the physical, but really that's the mental then. That's most important. So whether the person is kind or not kind, generous or not generous, angry or not, just the mental consciousness. Really, the main defining aggregate is the mental consciousness. It's the most important one. Which is also why some of the philosophical schools say the mental consciousness is the person. They don't feel comfortable with this idea, oh, can't be found, because it seems you end up with nothing. Therefore, they say, okay, the mental consciousness, that's the person, because that's the main important, the most important aggregate, and that is transformed. So a Buddha is a Buddha because of his mental consciousness, mainly. Yeah? All the other aggregates are secondary. Sense consciousness is secondary. Physical, secondary. So the mental consciousness, most important. Those are the realizations. Right. Yes, absolutely. But we need to take a break here. We have half an hour break, and then we have one more hour, right? Is that right? Okay. So then I want to say a little bit of past and future lives, a little bit. It's actually more in the context of great compassion, but I chose to kind of leave it aside a little bit. Okay, so past and future lives, and then we still have the protector left, and that should do. So I've actually described the five factors, and you have at least some sense of the second chapter, which may encourage you to continue studying. But first, enjoy your break.